I'm Gregory Berg. On April 12th, Canadian-American journalist Robert McNeil died at the age of 93. He was best known as co-creator and co-anchor of the PBS program that came to be known as the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour, and which is still on the air today as the PBS News Hour. He also helped to develop a wonderful PBS-BBC series about our language titled The Story of English. I was privileged to record an interview with Robert McNeil back in 2003. I want to play it for you now in his memory. And what a tremendous thrill and honor it is for me to be speaking with highly acclaimed broadcast journalist Robert McNeil, who is also an author. You've perhaps read his book, The Story of English. His most recent book is called Looking for My Country, Finding Myself in America. This is a really interesting book published by Harcourt, in which he not only tells us quite a lot about his career as a journalist and something about his personal life, but also the fact that his personal life and his professional career have taken him from his native Canada to Great Britain, to the United States, and sort of back and forth in a wonderful weaving pattern, which is really made his life more interesting in so many different ways. And we read about that in this beautifully crafted book. And I'm so pleased that Robert McNeil can join us for a few minutes to talk about his book and his career as a journalist. Robert McNeil, we welcome you to the Morning
Show. Thank you, Greg.
What would you say are the most important gains and also the most important or significant losses for you as a journalist in the fact that you have had this interesting career that has crisscrossed the Atlantic and taken you into all kinds of different arenas versus other journalists who, for whatever reason, find themselves pretty much in the same anchor chair for basically all of their professional life?
Well, I think it's more fun, for one thing, to go to different places. It's also been a challenge, interesting challenge journalistically, to be a reporter to the British about Britain, to Americans about Britain, to Canadians about Britain, to Americans about Americans, and it is, you have to change your sort of focus each time, and that's been an interesting exercise. I think what I missed, probably, is not having grown up in this country and not having developed my patriotism as you do when you do from a child, when you first pledge allegiance to the flag and you thrill when it flies and when the troops go into war carrying it and everything. I grew up under other flags, seeing troops in other uniforms, and when I was a child, thrilling to them. And so my career here a bit cooler about all that sort of thing than a native-born American would have been. I've always been a bit distressed, even today, and maybe especially today, by the kind of competitive patriotism there is in this country, which was quite different from what I grew up with in Canada and looking to Britain. And that's very much in evidence right now, I think.
You point out some very interesting differences between your native Canada and the United States. At one point, you say Canadians tend to look at the United States through two ends of the telescope alternately, close up and sympathetically, distantly and critically, over-magnifying and belittling. How fascinating that both of those things can occur.
And we're talking about America's closest friends, not only America's immediate neighbors, but also the people in the world who are most like Americans in their hopes and fears and their lifestyles and their material prosperity. But it's true. Canadians have to defend themselves against two things. One is the crushing fact of the North and the cold weather that comes down from the Arctic. I mean, Canada's population, for the most part, exists on a narrow band within 100 miles of the American border, a sort of ribbon, 100 miles wide, 3,000 miles long. And that's one fact of life. The other is, to the south, there is this huge and enormously boisterous and successful and extrovert country, which has all the things that Canadians want, but has a few things Canadians don't want. So they have to say to themselves, well, I like all that, but we're not American. We're like them, but we're not American. And I think that's, so it's a bit like the sort of Irish spinster pulling aside the lace curtains and saying the neighbor has bought another new television set and sort of despising them for it while at the same time wanting it. You know what I mean? So I think that's part of it.
We're speaking with Robert McNeil. His book is Looking for My Country, Finding Myself in America. Although probably you spend most of the book talking about your career as a journalist and this interesting experience you've had of living and working in various countries and eventually settling here in the United States. Another interesting surprise for me was the fact that you were an aspiring actor and playwright, and in fact pursued the possibility of being a playwright for a long time. Yeah. I was astonished by that, only because, I mean, you are not Geraldo Rivera or some of these other kind of razzle-dazzle sorts of journalists. That just seems so contrary to the kind of journalist you are.
Well, I would have made a lousy actor. I mean, the stage found out very quickly that I would have made a lousy actor, fortunately for me. And I had an epiphany. On a September day in 1952, a hot, hot September day, I'd come to New York after a summer of stock to look for work as an actor. And I was living on grapes and feeling very sorry for myself because everybody had said no. And I was standing on an island in Times Square, and suddenly a voice spoke to me in my head, like the voice of God, and said, "You'd make a terrible actor. You have some technical skills, but you're much too constricted to be an actor. You're meant to be a writer, the cool one behind the scenes. And if you're going to be a writer, you better get yourself some more education." And so I went back to Canada and went to college and incidentally put myself through college by being a disc jockey. But so that was very fortunate. The playwriting bug has not gone out of my system. In fact, I've spent a lot of the last couple of years working on a play, for which I still have some hopes. It's at Workshop Productions and things, and I can't get that bug out.
You talk about how, as a journalist, you just happened to be on the scene in Berlin for that incredible night when almost overnight the Berlin Wall was built.
Yeah.
You just happened to be in Washington the day of President Kennedy's announcement that night that there were missiles in Cuba.
Right.
I'm struck by the fact that for a journalist, part of what makes covering a great story possible is the good fortune of just happening to be there.
A series of accidents. For instance, I was the number two White House correspondent for NBC and had never been on a full presidential trip. I was new at this. The main correspondent, my colleague Sandy Van Oker, had gone off to Hawaii with a lot of senior cabinet members for a meeting on the Vietnam War. So I got to go to the Texas trip and was in Dallas when Kennedy was shot. I mean, those kinds of accidents, you have no control over at all, and you just hope that when you're faced with it, you can do something with the story that won't look silly.
I had the pleasure of interviewing the author of President Kennedy Has Been Shot, the new book from Source Books, and you are quoted extensively in that, and some of your work is part of that companion CD.
Yeah.
She points out, or you point out, even something like riding a press bus, and what do you do in the moment when chaos breaks out? Do I stay on the bus, or do I get off the bus? You chose to get off the bus and ended up being in the midst of a story in a way that most of your colleagues were not.
It's very funny. I was just interviewed by the sixth-floor museum in Dallas, the museum that's been created at that site, and they have talked to the bus driver. They found the bus driver and talked to him, and he said, "I remember that crazy guy insisted on getting off the bus, and he was the only one who did."
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and then someone else talks about these journalists screaming at the bus driver, you know, that we can't head over to this mart where this speech was going to take place because nothing was going to be happening there, and he dutifully took them all there, and here you were actually in the school book depository itself. And
well, then in the hospital. I got there very fast afterwards, it was... Now, there's a story that made me think twice about my decision to move my family to the United States, which I'd just done. I was very deeply depressed after Kennedy's assassination, and I'm not a depressive personality. I thought, how could this have happened? What is this virus of violence that can happen? And why can't political differences be metabolized through the political system? Is this the country I want my kids to grow up in? Well, it took me some months to sort of get over that, but I got over it.
One of the interesting experiences of your life after that was covering the presidential campaign of 1964,
yeah,
and following the Republican candidate Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, right.
You point out a number of interesting things. One of them is that you think Goldwater was, in some respects, a misunderstood person, and you found him more sympathetic than I think you really expected him to be. And the other thing is you really got to see the country and really knew America in a way that you'd never known it before.
Oh, it was astonishing. In six weeks in the fall of 1963, when Goldwater was doing a last exploratory trip around the country, this is before the Kennedy assassination, I was one of the few reporters assigned to go around the country with him, and it was just amazing. Here I was, newly arrived in the United States, and suddenly I was hopping all over the country with him and seeing a lot of it that people just don't get to see, and becoming very friendly with Goldwater. I really liked him as a person, as most of us did. I think we all felt that the rather harsh rhetoric that was written for him during that campaign just didn't, and he often delivered in a very dutiful way, was out of keeping with the nice guy who was underneath that.
Interesting.
I had a wonderful moment with him. Have we got another second?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
After he announced he was retiring from the Senate, and I went down to Washington to interview him for the NewsHour, sort of an old-time interview, you know, like, remember the nostalgic interview. We finished the interview, and I thought, well, I've got a nice warm piece about Goldwater leaves his political career. And I returned the camera off, and he said to me, well, aren't you going to ask about the Iran arms sales? And it had just come out that the Reagan administration had sold arms to Iran, and to the Contras, I mean. I said, well, yeah, if I did, if I turn on the camera, what should you say? And he said, I'd say it was the goddamn stupidest foreign policy blunder this country's ever been in. So I said, turn on the camera. And he said virtually that in just almost as salty terms. And it happened that Jim Lehrer was having lunch at the White House with some reporters and Ronald Reagan, and Jim told Reagan, and Reagan went white. And then they began the whole business of distancing Reagan from the Iran-Contra thing. And we led the show that night with Goldwater's thing, because he'd said to me, aren't you going to ask me about this?
Wow. You have encountered so many politicians over the years. At one point you say that you learned, I think this goes actually back to 1964, you said that you learned about American character, our thirst for authenticity and principled leadership, and the endearing idiocies and excesses that politics create.
Yeah.
I'm flabbergasted that some would call the idiocies and excesses of politics endearing in any way. In what way could they possibly be endearing, especially to someone like you that covered them as a business for year upon year?
Well, if you're going to be a political reporter, you better find the foibles of campaign endearing. Now, obviously, there are things that are disgusting in campaigns. I mean, I'm not very happy right now with the way Bush and Kerry are going after each other on the patriotism represented by their military service. I suppose it's inevitable. But I think it ill behooves a president who sat out the Vietnam War in the Texas National Guard with some absences to attack the patriotism of a guy like Kerry, who actually went and fought and got wounded, and for Kerry also to use that the other way around. I think it's unseemly. But anyway, those are things I don't like. But then there's just a lot of petty, silly stuff on campaigns that you find along the way, and you learn to treat it with a smile. I think the character attack side has grown so much more since those days. I mean, the world was shocked when the Democrats came up with a campaign commercial in 1964 that suggested that Barry Goldwater would be wild with nuclear weapons. It was the famous Daisy commercial.
Oh, yes, it only ran once, you tell
us. Only ran once, but everybody was so appalled that it was taken off immediately. You know,
it's hard to imagine that state of appallment today.
We are a lot less squeamish
than
we were. But mind you, Goldwater had given the Democrats good ammunition. He'd suggested that NATO commanders in Europe should have the authority to use tactical nuclear weapons on their own. I mean, my God.
Hmm. Let's talk about the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, which you helped to create for public television. I was so struck when you said there should be one place on television where things could be slowed down, where a quiet, more thoughtful treatment of the daily news would be possible. And, of course, we're talking about the mid-1970s. We're not even talking about 2004, when there's probably a far more acute need for that sort of thing.
Well, I think that watching the NewsHour every night, as I do, and Jim Lehrer is a friend, very close friend and colleague and business partner of mine, I feel that the more it stays, he keeps it with the same kind of aesthetic, quieter, more thoughtful, the more its strength shows against all the rivals, and there are many more rivals now than there used to be.
One of the things you made the decision that you wanted to be producers and not just anchors. That was not an easy thing to achieve.
No, in fact, we were told we couldn't do it, and I said, well, if we can't do it, hell with it. I'm going back to Britain to my job at the BBC, and I did for 2 years.
Mm.
And then finally, the New York station, which was run then by a very enlightened bunch of guys, said, well, come here and do it. You can do anything you like. And that was an extraordinary thing, to be told. They didn't even say, what exactly are you going to do? They said, come and start a new show.
Wow. One of the other choices you made was that you say you inverted the usual pyramid of television economy, production values dominating editorial, with beat reporters heavily outnumbering producers.
Yeah.
That says something about what was important to you and Mr. Lehrer.
Yeah, and we got away with it in that first sort of formation of what was the report. A half-hour show, which was just largely talking heads, talking about one subject. When we went to the hour and we had more, as they say, production values and documentary pieces and that sort of thing, then we had to change the ratio again. We had to have more producers. And we practically killed the two producers we had in the half-hour anyway, because they had to do a half-hour show every other night. And anyway.
Let's return to the issue of becoming an American and your evolving sense of what America is all about. You grew up in Canada and subtly and otherwise kind of indoctrinated with certain reservations about who Americans were and what were important to them. But you say that over time, and especially the more you knew Americans and worked with Americans, many of those reservations were sort of worn away. What attitude towards the United States has taken the place of your earlier reservations?
Well, you tend to see a country from another country in terms of shorthand and caricatures, and you see it through the insecurities and the sometimes you see it through the egos of other countries. So looking at the States through Canadian eyes, you see this this colossus which has everything you want and a few things you don't want, but you don't want to be absorbed by it. You don't want to be subsumed by this great Leviathan of America. You want to share the standard of living, but you don't want to become a political part of the United States because you have your own political culture. Therefore, other people around the world don't notice the difference. So Canadians, as part of their definition, will say, well, we're not Americans. Canadians are almost Americans. So the Canadians of my generation would look at Americans and see a rather swaggering, blustering, extrovert country in personality compared to what they thought of themselves as rather more introverted, quieter, better behaved, more polite, all those things. So you see a country through the prism of your own, probably your own weaknesses as well as strengths. I've just heard a little beep.
Yes, I think that means I'm supposed to thank you for your time. The book is Looking for My Country, Finding Myself in America. Robert McNeil, what a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, you're really nice to do this. Thank you.